This episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you in part by Mac and Emily. Thanks for your support, guys. You too can become a Blotter Presents tipster at patreon.com/blotterpresents. And now, on with today's episode.
I really don't care. I don't care if we shoot him, or we strangle him, or we poison him, or we bludgeon him, or we tie him up in a sack and drop him in the Thames. There is only one way for us to survive. Norman Scott has got to die, so how?
Hello, governors. Today we'll be contemplating two very English scandals. The first, an Amazon Prime series literally called A Very English Scandal that examines the Thorpe Affair, English sodomy and libel laws in 60s and 70s Britain, and the idea of the imperfect victim, and a 1989 TV show about the 1989 movie called Scandal that dredged up the Profumo Affair and all the questions of race, class, and Cold War hijinks English politicians didn't want raised again. Mark Blankenship and I have some questions about John Hurt's hair and what one feeds a pet badger, and we'll be getting into it in The Blotter Presents, episode 84. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast examining the idea that while crime is bad, some of the stories about crime can be pretty good. I am thrilled to be joined once again by Mark Blankenship, my co-host on Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs, and possessor of the Memorial Teddy Ruxpin Accent Chair. Hello, Mark.
Why, hello there, Sarah. I'm chuffed to be speaking about my British compatriots today.
You sound so... What is the word? Not sober. You do sound relatively demure, Teddy.
Well,
today.
Sarah, in the speech of such terrible crimes, one wants one's full faculties to discuss them properly.
and now I feel that we're in Yorkshire.
You don't know who's coming on this podcast today.
I really don't, and that's one of the things that makes it so wonderful. It was you who suggested... Our most wanted topic for today, A Very English Scandal. I'm going to read the case file quickly, and then I'd like to talk to you about that series and why you brought it to us. Here is that case file, which I really condensed down from Wikipedia because it gets it's kind of complicated, and yet at the end of the day, it's really pretty simple. The Thorpe Affair arose from allegations by Norman Joseph, otherwise known as Norman Scott, that he and Jeremy Thorpe had had a homosexual relationship in the early 1960s and that Thorpe had begun a badly planned conspiracy to murder Joseph, who was threatening to expose their affair. Jeremy Thorpe was an MP, so that's why this matters. He wasn't just some civilian. The alleged conspiracy led to not only the unfortunate collateral murder of a Great Dane, but charges against Thorpe, of which he and his three co-respondents were acquitted in the late 70s, although Thorpe's career was ruined, and his defense attorney's reduction of Norman to a scuzzy blackmailer were not a good look for anyone. But was Norman a scuzzy blackmailer? A desperate victim? A complex combination, at least as illuminated by Ben Whishaw's Golden Globe-winning performance as Norman? There is lots to unpack in the Stephen Frears directed three-part series on Amazon Prime, so let's get started. Mark, what made you think that this would be a good topic for us, besides the crime aspect?
Well, you know, when I suggested it, I hadn't even watched it yet, but I had seen Ben Whishaw win his Golden Globe, and I had kind of forgotten about this miniseries, though I remembered
Same.
But then I remembered when I had heard about it last year, I thought, oh, that might be pretty good. And I thought, well, this seems like the kind of show that if it's good or it's bad, it's going to give you and I a lot to dig our teeth into because there are questions about sexuality, class,
murder. I mean, it's sort of all of the things that we talk about all the time anyway. I mean, maybe we don't talk about murder as much, but then maybe we do now that I think about half those conversations at my birthday getaway. Anyway.
Well, and also that you want to murder the entire back catalog of Train, the band. But
yes.
That's more of a metaphorical thing.
Yes. And also just the fact that the people involved in making this thing, you mentioned Stephen Frears and then Russell T. Davies, who was a driving force behind the creation of Queer as Folk and things, was credited as the writer. It just
I think maybe Frears wrote it and Davies directed it. I may have misspoken on that.
Oh no, I think you're right that it was Russell T. Davies did write it and Stephen Frears directed it.
Okay.
So says IMDb.
Okay,
but you know, just knowing that these were the people involved made me confident that it would be worth watching.
Agree. I had sort of been dimly aware of it, but wasn't really familiar with the story. Prior to watching this, I didn't know that this had gone on. So I was glad that you brought it to my attention. I think the last limited series that I watched with Ben Whishaw, which was, I think, The British The Night Of.
Wait, did you see the one where his boyfriend was a spy?
Yes, that one was also excellent.
I saw that one and really liked it.
Yeah.
I did not see The Night Of.
So I feel like I've had good luck with Ben Whishaw projects generally. I loved Bright Star. I was the one who was like, this should have been nominated for Best Picture. I mean, it shouldn't have probably, but I really liked it. And I've had good luck with limited series starring him, and so did this limited series because he won a Golden Globe. We will get into his performance a little bit later, but I wanted to know your general thoughts on the series just as a 3-episode, like, structured creature. Did you think that was the right length? How did you feel about the structuring? Did you feel that it was the right amount of humorous editing and chyrons whizzing by?
I loved it. I thought it was incredibly entertaining. It was, to my mind, the perfect length. Given that at the end of the day, there's not that much story here, really. But one of the things that the show did so successfully was tease out these large themes from what the case represented, because this ended up being a miniseries as much about the horrifying criminalization of homosexuality as anything else. And the fact that it managed to be about that plus attempted murder while also still being very, very funny and surprisingly touching, to me made it a perfect example of what a gay sensibility can give you in art, which is a simultaneous appreciation for the tragic and the hilarious, or I guess as John Waters says in that episode of The Simpsons when he describes camp, the tragically ludicrous and the ludicrously tragic.
Yeah.
And I felt like the sensibility of the show was so jarring and wonderful, and I was pleased to live with it for the time that I did.
Same. So it seemed to slow down a bit in the last episode of the three, but I think that generally that is because this story in real life begins in like the early 60s, and then it gets to court almost 20 years later, 15, 20 years later. So what they have to do in terms of remaining true to events, and I believe this is based on the book by John Preston. I have not read that book. But what they have to do in terms of remaining true to events while also preserving momentum and stopping when it's important to stop, but then sort of whizzing past. Like, you don't want to do like a listy bio kind of thing.
Right.
But there are points where like you do have to cover actual like information so that other stuff later will be more significant. So I thought they did an excellent job with that. And I found myself thinking about what I was talking about last week when Toby Ball and I were discussing Murder Mountain and how the criminalization of normal, understandable human activity creates this ripple of other crimes. So the sort of foundation crime, which like, doy, that's, it's not a crime, but sodomy was not legal in the UK at the time the series begins. And I think, and we sort of see the process of it being legalized in the, in Commons, I guess. I admit that my understanding of the senatorial workings of Great Britain, given how much The Crown I've watched, is probably less than it should be. But that we see part of that process beginning to happen to make it, you know, legal, to decriminalize it. But that this is a foundation crime, which is horseshit, but then it creates blackmail, and the blackmail then creates this conspiracy to commit murder, is like, are you happy now, homophobes? Great job.
Yeah, and I really found myself thinking a lot about the feedback loop that gets created by a homophobic or racist or sexist law, because, you know, gay, but in this case in point, as we see in this miniseries, and as we've seen so often in history and in the present world, gay men's behavior is criminalized, but gay men are sexual beings because they are human beings. So when they are told that they can't have sex legally, they naturally go and look for sex in places where they can be surreptitious and still be able to express their human desires, which leads to sex in parks, in bathrooms, in underlit public places. And then they get arrested for those very behaviors. And then homophobes are able to say, see, this is why we outlawed your sexual behavior, because you're deviants and you're gross, when actually it's the laws in the first place that forced gay people out into these environments, because it was the only way that they knew to satisfy their needs, because society had told them that they weren't allowed to express who they were in public. And this film does such a great job of showing you how the snake keeps eating its own tail in this way.
Yeah.
And the homophobia leads to actions that no one really feels, I don't want to say that no one feels great. Some people prefer exhibitionist sex or whatever. But, you know, but the homophobic laws lead to actions that homophobes then use to justify their act, their laws. And the dehumanization that it is required is so staggering. And this is jumping a bit to the end, but one of the things that I found so wonderful about this series was in that last moment after Jeremy Thorpe, as played brilliantly by Hugh Grant, has ended the trial and or is in the process of awaiting for the jury verdict, and his lawyer says, why did you stick with this guy, this crazy neurotic guy? And you see this flashback sequence of all of the men that Hugh Grant had surreptitiously picked up, and how each one of them ended up with him getting beaten, robbed, terrorized in some way. And he says, well, because Norman Joseph or Norman Scott or whatever, he was decent. And you just realize that, oh shit, right, because all people want is the chance to express themselves and be loved. And it's worth taking a risk on someone who's a little neurotic, because the homophobic society you're in has curdled and warped men's sexuality to the point that violence is so often the result. So if you find a port in the storm, even if it's neurotic, you hang on. And I thought the show did a great job of making that feel palpable.
Well, and you also see this with sex work of all kinds, but
yes,
not only are you creating crimes out of people just trying to be who they are and find a, you know, find a sexual outlet, which is perfectly normal, but then all of that becomes criminalized, everything you said. And then in the event that they are attacked or rolled or whatever happens, that's not going to be reported. And there is a certain kind of predator that will take advantage of that. So then you're creating a whole other subset of crimes that can't
yes.
be brought to justice and are not discussed and then flourish in the dark, because that's what happens. And it's gross. And the we meet this little gnome of a man who gets the ball rolling to sort of, you know, let's just put a stop to this. His attitude is not exactly enlightened. as to, quote, these poor buggers and what will become of them once this behavior is decriminalized. But I clipped this little scene just to, remind us that this attitude was perhaps the best that could have been hoped for at the time, unfortunately, at least until we meet Ms. Edna Friendship, but we'll get to her.
Oh my God.
But also yes. Because the nicknames that some of the British upper crust like have and embrace are hilarious to me and just sort of baffling. And that's at the very end of clip two.
A private member's bill for the Commons next month.
Well, you're a brave man.
My wife says I'm brave for wearing this waistcoat. Make no mistake, though. I don't believe those lost souls will ever be happy. But it's our duty in Parliament to help them. Poor bloody queers. My first proposal, I asked the Lord Chancellor. Do you know what he said?
I will refuse to sit in any cabinet meeting where this filthy subject is even being discussed. We would be licensing buggers clubs. I have no desire to go down in history as the man responsible for legalizing sodomy in Britain.
But then finally, I found someone to help me. Mm-hmm. Lord Arran.
Boofy?
Boofy.
Boofy. God bless Boofy.
Oh, Boofy. I feel like that clip also really demonstrates the excellence of the acting and the line readings in this thing. I mean, the clipped perfect enunciation from that one pissed off guy. Yes.
Well, and you know what? I guess that guy did go down in history as yeah. legalizing sodomy. And you know what? Generations. Thank you. Because yeah. it's about goddamn time. Just mind your own business. It's fine. But I wanted to talk to you about how the series wants us to feel about Jeremy Thorpe.
Mm.
Because I am not 100% on how it wants us to feel, which is okay. That ambiguity of this, of both the central figures, I think is one of the strengths of the yes. series. Particularly Norman, but Jeremy as well. I didn't clip anything from this because really the visual of, you know, Norman has come to stay at his mother's house and Jeremy has sort of crept into the guest room and clonked a jar of petroleum jelly down on the nightstand, at which time Norman bursts into tears. Norman says they are of gratitude. I feel like that's perhaps not the emotion that was being experienced by young Norman, but there is definitely this sense that he is expected to earn his keep mm-hmm. with Jeremy. And I wondered what you thought of that portrayal of Jeremy, of like how you read that scene, whether you sort of felt comfortable like rooting for Jeremy after that, or whether you thought we were supposed to. What did you think about that?
Well, let me also add that this is the scene where Jeremy playfully chides Norman for shivering like a little bunny. And that nickname becomes very
yes,
important in the story. I have to say, to me, I felt, given my own history of growing up gay in the South in the 90s, I felt enormous sympathy for both Norman and for Jeremy, and could see, I felt that I saw in both of them these two wounded, decent people who had been so warped by the nightmare of a life that they had been forced to live that this is just the best they could do. Now, like Norman is a complete mess. He's a flake. He can't hold a job. He screams at people. He's sometimes fine. He's other times not fine. He totally is a schemer who's out for himself. He marries women. He marries a woman at one point.
But he's kind to animals.
But at the same time, right. He's also lovely, funny, sweet, charming, endearing. And I don't know. I just always prefer to give gay people in these situations the benefit of the doubt, that, you know, you're raised with so much shame and it does so much to you that if you get out of it halfway normal, then God bless. And for Jeremy, too, he was raised as someone who was taught that it was his birthright to be powerful, to be influential. And class being what it is in Britain, it's hard to be raised with that and then learn, oh, except I'm not allowed to exist after all. So the fact that he was able to express any kind of love at all, albeit twisted and controlling, makes it complicated. And I think that the show does a great job of demonstrating on both counts, but particularly with Jeremy, since you brought him up first, that these are deeply wrong people doing deeply wrong things who are also worthy of love and who are trying to figure things out. And the refusal to make either one of them purely heroic or purely villainous is, I think, pretty great. And I think it also, that ambiguity is what gives the show so much space to be funny, because if you haven't quite decided that your character is all one or the other, that means they can be clowns sometimes, and other times they can be full of pathos. And I thought in that scene that also Hugh Grant, who really should have gotten an Emmy nomination or a Golden Globe nomination. Well, he did get a Golden Globe nomination, but he was so good in that scene and in this whole movie at playing this combination of entitlement, lust, fear, love. He really captures all of the conflict in that. And it doesn't hurt that I find him so charming, as does almost anyone who's ever watched him on screen. So I felt it was easy to root for him, even as I understood that he was in the wrong most of the time. And honestly, I kind of like living in that ambiguity, not to pull out this old saw, but in these times, we tend to have such dire one way or the other political conversations. Sometimes I think rightly so, but it's nice sometimes to sit in a little bit more ambiguity where the thing that's wrong is the law. And then we're asked to look at the people who are curdled and twisted by that law and realize that it's hard. And there's clearly some terrible actions being taken, but they're not all terrible.
Well, and that I think if you're sort of still in this like arrested development with your like the just day-to-day living of your sexuality, where you still live with your mom, and you're creeping into the lodger's room, and sort of the two of you have been vibing. Like, I am not trying to say that like an assault occurred here or that there was not consent, but I think you're absolutely right that, you know, by the teeny little bedside lamp in whispers is not perhaps the ideal efflorescence of this, you know, sexual congress. And there's also, I think, to an extent that perhaps is not accessible to Americans, this idea that there's like what goes on at school amongst boys, and then there's your actual life and never the twain, etc., which they lay out fairly clearly in that opening scene between Jeremy Thorpe and his bestie, Peter Bessel. Is that his name?
Oh, God,
And, I mean, I don't think we really have much of him in the clips, but Alex Jennings, his tiny eye rolls and head cocks made my life. And he's so delightful. And I think this person in real life was like pretending to have had more gay experience and to be further over on the Kinsey scale than he was, so that he could be friends with Jeremy Thorpe, which I just thought was so alien to me. I just thought that was, I don't know, it was very like weird and charming, and the performance is really fantastic.
It really is, and that's another fascinating part of this story, is that Jeremy Thorpe was considered to be a potential prime minister, and he clearly had this incredible charisma. So another thing that the show does is demonstrate how quickly he was able to convince multiple people in high-ranking positions to just go along with his plan to put a hit out on Norman.
Yeah.
And you just see these two guys that work with him. This I can't remember. The one you were just talking about, Bissell, and then this other guy whose name I can't remember. But they're both
David
like...
David Holmes.
Yeah.
Who,
that's right.
You'll see this in the visual aids, which you will find on social media. That's at Blotter Presents on Facebook and Twitter. There was a... card at the in the end credits that said that David Holmes, who I think was pretty out and proud for the time, like lived with his partner.
Yes, which they also show you. Yeah.
And he opened a roller disco.
Yes.
And I just, I was like, that is the best goddamn Chiron. I know it's early, but that's in the running for the best Chiron of 2019. Remind me in December that I said that.
Yeah.
Like, Thorpe is thundering away to Bessel about that he needs to go and find Norman and warn him off. And then there's like a smash cut to a plane landing. And the instructions are so specific and hilarious. And then this cut is brilliant. I clipped the whole thing, and here is clip three.
And you make it very clear that he is not to contact me ever. He is not to talk about our former association in any shape or form. And he is not to write to my mother describing acts of anal sex under any circumstances whatsoever.
And off Bessel goes to... And then there's
he is not to write to my mother describing acts of anal sex.
Just,
you know,
like numerous slapsticky bits with people who are supposed to be controlling Norman, like just not being able to get him into a car or objecting to his giant dog or like, oh, now it's raining and it's a whole thing. I mean, and I think that light touch that it's like, I mean, when you think about the history of this law and the many talented lives that it took, just that we know about, Turing, the Ballad of Reading Jail, just to name two.
Yes.
The fact that they can find the humor in not just in the sort of ineptitude of the situation, but that they can throw that back to reflect on the law itself is pretty wonderful. So,
and that's a great segue into the clips that I called for, because they also do a great job of demonstrating how much it fucked over women to have to live with this law. Because you see all of these women who come into both Norman and Jeremy's lives with these open hearts and these high hopes, and instead they also get caught up in the maelstrom. And talk about an actress who I think merits some sort of prize for what amounts to roughly 4 minutes of screen time. Late in the series, we meet Marion Thorpe, who is Jeremy Thorpe's second wife, and she reveals herself to be a very fascinating and complex character, as brilliantly played by Monica Dolan. And she has two moments that I think are so great and underscore why I loved this show. Here is the first clip of her as Marion talking about the press revelations of the affair, and specifically the revelation that Jeremy referred to Norman as Bunny.
Technically, he was Bunny, a singular.
Then why did you say bunnies? Were there two of you? Are you a bunny? Am I married to a bunny?
The asperity of the tone. He goes on to explain grammatically what he was doing with Bunny and bunnies in this way that's like, and then she just makes this face that's like, really? You're going to usage explain this to me? You're gay. And back to the point.
And let me assure you that my husband and I have been saying, are you a bunny?
Am I married to a bunny? I call most of my cats bunny at some point during the day. Well, who's a little bunny butt? So, oh, hello.
Am I mother to a bunny?
Are you a bunny?
Well, yes.
Is my child a bunny?
And then later, Jeremy is at dinner with Marion and trying to put some sort of crazy rationale around his behavior and how it was just in the times, I was only buggering Norman when there were no women for 50 miles in any direction. And again, Monica Dolan brilliantly delivers this monologue, which turns into something, I think, deeper than I was anticipating when I first heard it.
Indeed. This is a bit of a long clip, and much of the work is being done in Hugh Grant's face. So if you haven't watched this yet, let this be a teaser for you to watch it. But I think you'll get the gist in clip 5.
So this thing with Norman Scott, it wasn't a relationship?
How could it be?
Jeremy, I'm not a fool. I practically grew up with Benjamin Britten. I've seen something of the world. I fled from Hitler, for God's sake. My own son married a hippie in a yurt. And I've toured with orchestras. I couldn't begin to tell you the things I've seen, so there's no need to protect me.
I made mistakes. I've stopped. And I swear I had nothing to do with that gun and the dog.
Of course you
didn't. Jeremy, nothing to do with me.
I'm not even asking. I won't dignify it with discussion, and there's an end to it.
Thank you.
For what it's worth, I think people have focused on the word bunnies. But the last thing you wrote in that letter was, I miss you. I think that's a wonderful thing for a man to say to his friend. Are you all right?
Very nice dinner. Very nice.
Ugh.
I mean, and what a wonderful thing. What a wonderful thing for her to do. To just say, you know, I see you. And
yeah,
here I am seeing you and sitting back down at the table with my glass of port.
Like, I'm going to go ahead and call you out and clock you until you don't treat me like a fool. But then I'm also going to say you don't have to be banished because of it. And
this,
oh my God,
I mean, his response is, for a, you know, British man of his vintage, practically hysterical sobbing of relief. But naturally,
yes,
he's British. So he's like, Betty. Very nice dinner. And then her little thank you right after that is just, I mean, it's really like they do have a partnership. It's just perhaps not what either of them thought when they got married. So it was great to see it formed.
That has got to be the best Benjamin Britten joke I have heard in
For
weeks.
For God's sake. How many Benjamin Britten jokes do you hear?
More than you'd expect.
I mean, I actually expect a certain number. I was just wondering how many.
He was known as a bit of a bugger himself, old Benny.
Yeah, yes, he was.
Anyway, but now I think it's high time that we pay tribute to our Golden Globe winning star, Mr. Ben Whishaw, and his performance, which also I found to be so captivating, so layered. He makes Norman both insufferable and irresistible simultaneously,
yes,
at all times.
That's exactly right. The next clip is this absolute gust of information that could be a con. Like, I think it's all true, but I think his way of like pitching it to this, you know, target that he has selected to get some help. Plus, he's holding a dog named Mrs. Tish. Who's extremely cute, by the way. And the way he pitches this is perfect, but then he often can turn on a dime from this pitiableness to petulance. Well, let's hear the clip, and then we can discuss.
Well, the thing is, when I ran away from Mr. Van der Vaarter, I had to leave my national insurance card behind, and I can hardly ask for it back, can I? Not now. Which means I won't be able to work. And if I can't get work, then I can't get a place to live, and if I don't have a permanent address, then I can't get my prescription, so I'm stuck, Jeremy. I'm completely stuck, and I've got nowhere to stay.
I mean, and this is, I think, the beauty of this perfectly pitched and not vain performance by Wishaw is that he is a human being and is complicated and not perfect, just like Jeremy Thorpe and just like, you know, everyone is, and that the series and the writing are not afraid to have him tacking back and forth between, you know, he's being a jackass, but how much of this and how much of his situation is a result of the circumstances under which he's been forced to, like, basically veil himself.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I mean, it's quite impressive. And then they sort of, I mean, his hair gets more and more moppish to mark the passage of time, but the performance also gets a little more out to mark the passage of time, I think. And it was a very carefully modulated thing that Wishaw did, especially that I found especially effective in light of his closely guarded life in real life, that he has, you know, said for years, like, well, I just don't think anyone cares. I don't understand what it is to be a celebrity. And it was like, well, that'll work for a while, but eventually, you know, eventually it'll get you. So I found myself thinking about that, and also how disappointed I remain that he was not Freddie Mercury. Nothing against Rami Malek, who I love.
Oh, God, yeah. Well, first of all, wouldn't it have been nice for an actually out gay actor to play Freddie Mercury? Mm. Call me crazy.
Well,
but, you know,
there's a whole there's a big basket of problems with all of that that we're just not going to uncover.
We're not going to even. I find that Ben Wishaw is, I just find him to be a very inspiring actor, because he did eventually, as you were just alluding to, come out and just say, yes, gay, yes. But I feel like he's just been so matter of fact about it, and he's worked so steadily, and I feel like he's done such a great job of playing really interesting and complicated gay characters, including in a play that I saw a few years ago called The Pride, which was so wonderful here in New York. But he's also played roles like he was the dad in Mary Poppins Returns. He was grown up Michael Banks. And I just think the breadth and depth of his career is great. He's also the voice of Paddington in the Paddington movies.
Speaking of talking British bears,
as we tend to.
The next clip I have is, I thought was an interesting contrast the way they cut this. First, you have Jeremy Thorpe fuming about what, quote, fairies are like. And then you have Norman in court seemingly proving Jeremy's point, but at the same time disproving it with his fiery delivery. His pronunciation of the name Jeremy Thorpe is right up there with, if you are a listener to Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs, you may remember that I played a clip from Any Given Sunday in which we enjoyed LL Cool J's extremely angry pronunciation of the name Crozier. This,
which by now I have just started to use as a noun in and of itself, i.e., he's such a Crozier.
You are an offensive coordinate. I mean, I may play the clip after this. First, let's hear clip 7.
Idiot.
Norman Scott will talk.
But he doesn't know any of this is connected to you.
Except it is connected to me, and now you have given him center stage. You have put that stupid babbling man in a court with a gun and a motive and a dead dog, and on top of that, he's a bloody fairy. He will love it.
My lord, this whole thing is a travesty of justice. Because blaming that man with the gun is one thing, but I blame the man who gave him orders. The man who wants me dead. The man with whom I had a vigorous sexual relationship for very many years. And that man is Jeremy Thorpe.
A vigorous sexual relationship.
I mean, Jeremy Thorpe is not wrong. He is loving it, and he should be, because I think Norman has put up with just about enough shit.
And
Mark,
he never got his insurance card.
He never did. Oh, that poor man. Shall I play the LL Cool J clip just so people know kind of what I'm talking about. All right. It's not that long. Sorry, not Oliver Stone fans. You'll see what we mean in a sec.
Guys, we won. You know, what's the point here?
The point is I'm trying to fucking get paid. That's the point.
No, the point is if we don't win, you're not going to be able to do your chip and dip commercials, okay?
What the fuck do you know? You're an offensive coordinator. Crozier.
Jesus Christ.
I always forget the little Jesus Christ at the end.
I also love that you just had that clip ready.
Oh, yeah.
You never know. Yeah. You never know.
You don't. And yet, in your heart, you do.
Crozier.
All right. Thank you. This lady does love Cool James. Much of this series was funny, but I'd like to close up our discussion of the series with this speech that absolutely destroyed me. The aforementioned Boofy is talking with the other MP that we heard speaking with Jeremy Thorpe about introducing this bill, about his late brother.
I just want to say, in the spirit of letting this clip speak for itself, I will just say, after I hear this, I will be emotional. I think it says everything that I could ever say about it, and I think it's a great way of closing a discussion of a very worthy program.
Me too. So I will play the clip, and then we will move on, but I would be remiss if I did not note that this is David Bamber, and he wrecked me. There are, like, literally tear stains on my notes from when I was writing about this speech. Mr. Bamber, take it away.
When we were children, in the nursery, I'd reach out every night, hold his hand until he slept. He was such a clever boy. He translated the Three Musketeers, did you know? Penguin classic. And the deaths go on by hanging, by poison, by gas, men killing themselves through fear and shame. And I don't think it's suicide. I think it's murder. They are murdered by the laws of the land. And I think it's time it stopped.
I think that's goddamn right. Okay, on to the more cheery Profumo affair. In our cold case section, specifically, we're speaking about the Scandal story, which was actually an episode of another show that I kind of want to find more back issues of and watch more of them. But first, the case file, again, adapted from Wikipedia. The Profumo affair was a British political scandal that originated with a brief sexual. Oh my God, wish off for president. Relationship in 1961 between John Profumo, the Secretary of State for War in Harold Macmillan's government, and Christine Keeler, a 19-year-old would-be model. In March 1963, Profumo's denial of any impropriety was refuted a few weeks later with his admission of the truth, and he resigned from the government and from Parliament. When the Profumo-Keeler affair was first revealed, public interest was heightened by reports that Keeler may have been simultaneously involved with Captain Yevgeny Ivanov, a Soviet naval attaché, thereby creating a possible security risk. Keeler knew both Profumo and Ivanov through her friendship with Stephen Ward, an osteopath and socialite, who had taken her under his wing. The exposure of the affair generated rumors of other scandals and drew official attention to the activities of Ward, who was charged with a series of immorality offenses. Perceiving himself as a scapegoat for the misdeeds of others, Ward took a fatal overdose during the final stages of his trial, which found him guilty of living off the immoral earnings of Keeler and her friend Mandy Rice Davies. What I don't think I understand that they're not saying in the Wikipedia page, because just say it, is that they thought he was a pimp and that this crime was called poncing in Britain. So when you hear that in the clip later, you'll know that.
The peekaboo writing of this Wikipedia entry is so British marm. Just say you thought he was a pimp.
I know.
But instead it's guilty of living off the immoral earnings of Kilo and her friend. Like, come on.
Well, really. And it manages to be judgy of literally everyone in the situation, which is, I mean, sort of British, but also quite a feat. Anyway, the 1989 film, starring, among others, John Hurt, John Hurt's Hair, Joanne Whalley Kilmer, and Bridget Fonda, was itself something of a scandal thanks to A, an orgy scene in which two background extras were actually fucking in the background, thus nearly sticking the movie with an X rating, and B, the continued interest of British politicians in squelching the film generally 25 years after the events it portrayed had occurred. I also learned while I was doing a bit of research that Stephen Frears was considered to direct this project. The Scandal Story is an episode of a C4 series called The Media Show, and it's a pretty solid overview of L'Affaire Profumo and the race and class issues that let it consume the cultural mind in 60s Britain.
Because, and it actually took me a while to work this out too, so the show on C4 was The Media Show, the movie was called Scandal, and the affair was the Profumo affair. There's like so many layers of... And I'm also shocked that this Wikipedia write-up does not mention that Ian McKellen, with the world's craziest bald cap, is also in this movie.
And playing the guy who went to Christine Keeler's apartment and started shooting because she like wouldn't return his calls, which is what got the whole ball rolling on like the big reveal of her other involvements, was played by Roland Gift of Fine Young Cannibals in
Scandal. I mean, she drives me crazy, right?
Yeah. And she did have long black hair. Okay, so general thoughts. I liked that it was an hour. I liked all the vintage footage. You'll find a picture of Christine Keeler swigging and winking while she does it from a bottle of champagne in the visual aids. I liked all of that vintage material. I liked that they got a lot of the actual people, including Keeler, to talk about it and about the movie. And I liked that there were clips from the movie as well. And I really didn't... I mean, I thought it was just a political, like, hooker scandal. I don't think I realized that there was, like, a Cold War element or any of that. Or that it was possible that because this Johnny Edgecombe guy who came after her shooting was black, that might have been a lightning rod for a lot of this stuff. Like, I didn't know really the specifics of this, and now I do. So I think it's a pretty good overview for that. And also, I think the actual movie Scandal is like 3 hours long, so... unless you want to comb through it looking for the extras who are like literally boning in the background, this might save you some time. Did you find this enjoyable?
I did. Yeah, I wish that I had watched this before I watched the Profumo Affair episode of The Crown, because I really didn't get what that was about at the time. And going back, and the suggestion that Prince Philip was there at the osteopath's orgies and was maybe taking some of the photos that were later leaked to the press, that's really juicy stuff. And I, as is so often the case with The Crown, I remember watching it and thinking, if I were British, I would probably already know what this is about.
Yeah.
So that being said, yes, I thought that this was did a lovely job of laying out the many intricacies of this case. And one of the things that I now feel once and for all about the Profumo affair, having seen The Crown and this special, is I don't really understand why everyone got so worked up about it. I mean, yes, Johnny Edgecombe was upset that he felt his girlfriend was two-timing him, and so he went trying to shoot his way into her house. That is a crime. But then I feel like, okay, so she was also like sleeping around with some other guys. Like, it seemed like they had to invent a bunch of crap about prostitution and the Cold War to cover to really justify their cultural outrage that a white woman was sleeping with a black man and that a member of parliament was being too overt in his infidelities.
Yeah, I think that's basically it. I don't think you're wrong. I think that's what's going on. I found that it's interesting because we have a take on a TV show that is 30 years old about a movie that was being made at the same time that is now 30 years old about a like series of events that is 55 plus years old.
Right.
So, and you know, like that, whatever the producers are of Scandal are like on camera for this show and they're like smoking, obviously. And it, like, it's just, it's a little weird, but I, you know, that there's two prisms that we're looking through at this
right.
is interesting. I did think that it accidentally did a good job of pointing up the impossible position that the girl is always in mm-hmm. these situations, because like, first of all, the contemporary accounts were like, I think that we were meant to understand that sometime dancer was code for hooker and that aspiring model was code for hooker and minor starlet is usually code for hooker
and part-time secretary
yes.
is code for hooker
yes.
and working and mother of two is code for hooker.
And like manicurist emerita is code for hooker. And it's like, first of all, just say that she was a sex worker if you think you can prove it. And second of all, fucking who cares if she was. The next clip is it's from a like newsreel about dancers at this like belly dancing club. It's unclear to me whether Christine Keeler's in this footage, but then she comes in voiceover and talks about the experience of working at this club and being around the other girls. And I'd like to talk about that entire take on her narrative after we hear clip 9.
The glamour girls who dance the night away in one of the lushier nightclubs. Nice work. But who'd get up at 10 o'clock on the morning after to rehearse a new routine? Frankly, it's a tough life. So the girls from London's Cabaret Club go out to a country house near Guildford in Surrey at regular intervals for much-needed relaxation in the open air, a stately rest home for dancers.
I felt at home because all the other girls have felt at last I belong somewhere, because I didn't get on with my stepfather at home. And I loved Murray's, just with the girls and... It's like being at boarding school in many ways.
I just had to leave that clip. Peppy trombone. I mean, first of all, the narrator of the newsreel sounds like a parody of he sounds like a
it
Simpsons
like,
British person.
Or it sounds like the one of the newsreels in A League of
yes,
Their Own.
One of the lushier nightclubs. Like lushier.
It's really a retirement home
and
for
then
dancers.
There's this footage of the dancers like and they're like in these big wicker chairs on a lawn in Surrey, sipping drinks with many straws in them, and they keep sneaking looks at the camera like this is not like they're only giving us this stuff because you're here. And then they're playing croquet in 4-inch heels. So apparently they're there to like aerate the lawn on this country estate. As well as get some rest and relaxation. But that part's amazing. And then the volumes that Christine Keeler is not saying, like, I didn't get along with my stepfather.
Yeah.
That's the only thing that's not code for hooker. And I'm pretty sure that's code for he touched me and I had
right.
to leave home and I would do whatever I had to do. And then there's some other narration later that's like, the really, you know, charming thing about Christine is that she was extremely willing, but the thing that drove men mad is that you knew that she would be willing with someone else the minute the door closed on you. And this was said in an admiring tone, but there's just so much in there about, I don't know, like failing to understand the desperate straits in which a young woman mm-hmm. might find herself, judging and then judging her for doing what she has to do to literally survive. There's the, you know, failure to understand that sex work is work, if in fact that's what yes. she was doing and not just having affairs and being 19. Like, I mean, I don't know. Fuck any politicians at that age, but I was getting up to some pretty crazy shit.
This whole thing is just a morass of horrible social views.
Yeah. It is.
You can't spell morass without more ass.
I mean, it's really true. And she, as of this show, which it's on YouTube and will obviously it'll be in the show notes and y'all can watch it if you like. It is very informative, but there's definitely this, like, you know, this feeling that, like, she's lucky to be able to tell her side now, and that, and this casting of her as this, like, femme almost fatale that almost brought down the conservative government. And it's like, well, but she was 19, and who a married politician fucks is on the married politician and not her. And it's, yeah, it's just really, it's a lot. And I would really like to see, perhaps, Stephen Frears's take for Amazon Prime on this whole flap. Because I just think it might be a bit more wise and less judgy.
Yeah, and it would be interesting to see, with this much additional distance and social change, what would we make of the story now?
I'd also like, at some point, for someone to just do, like, a Netflix explainer series. It can be as long or short as they feel it needs to be. But as I said earlier in the podcast, I think that there are just issues of class and, like,
yes,
ways that aspirants to higher stations in the UK are terrorized by these divisions in a way that we, like, don't understand because we can't see them because we're not from there.
Right.
So here is a clip that is talking about the demise of poor Stephen Ward, almost convicted poncer, sigh, and why he could not face life after a guilty verdict, in clip 10.
The night before the verdict was delivered, Ward took an overdose of sleeping pills.
If they had arrested Stephen for spying, he probably wouldn't have committed suicide. But because they arrested him for poncing, which is something he didn't do, it was just too much for him to bear.
What really killed Steve was he was an incurable snob. And the idea that the knobs, the Astors, and the people, the royal family, you see, I mean, he'd drawn them all. The Queen Mother, Prince Philip, I think the present Queen, he'd drawn. Princess Marina, all of them had posed for him. And many other people, distinguished people. All this was going to go, and this meant everything to him, more than anything else, that sort of recognition, that social thing was going to go. And what would he be afterwards?
Well put, but, you know, at the end of the day, I'm not sure there was a crime here, except the cocking up, so to speak, of charges to make everyone look like they were properly burdened with rectitude in the situation. I mean, given that there didn't appear to have been any intrusion by the Soviets except by one possible Soviet penis, you know, there's no crime here. And yet, if he had been convicted of espionage, he would have sort of gutted it out. In prison, but losing access to the highest echelon of society and being able to sketch princesses was just absolutely catastrophic. And he took his own life. And I just need some Netflix professor to explain to me why that is.
Yeah.
But aside from sort of like that, the real crime is misogyny and like knee-jerk hysteria about infidelity that is technically none of our collective business, I'm not sure there's a crime here, but it's still a good overview of the Profumo affair. I just would like to see it redone by modern or a contemporary director. Who would you like to see do this?
Huh.
Would you like to see it fictionalized, or would you like a documentary on it? Or you don't care anymore?
Honestly, I think it would be interesting if this were, instead of whatever's supposed to be coming next on American Crime Story, if they could just pivot to British Crime Story.
Ooh.
And I would like Ryan Murphy to dig into this, because I feel like some of the things that are present in the assassination of Gianni Versace are present here as well.
Oh, yeah.
Because Andrew Cunanan, what did he want more than anything?
Mm-hmm.
He wanted access, and he didn't. He killed other people in the quest for it. But, you know, I'd like to see what old Rai could say about it.
Oh, God, yes. And the British, I mean, there's really so much British crime that I would love to see Ryan Murphy tackle in that way, because I just thought the world of the assassination of Gianni Versace. And
oh, me too.
Would love to see his take on it.
And of course, OJ. Mm,
yes, indeed. That too. All right, folks. Well, that's called The Scandal Story. You'll find that link in the show notes. And if you were always like, why are we supposed to care about this? I'm not sure that we answered that question, because I'm not sure there is an answer. But we did our best, and I do recommend it. It's a good explainer at 1 hour and 4 minutes. Speaking of good explainers, Mark, you are one. Where else can listeners find you explaining things about the world?
Well, you can find me along with Sarah at the podcast Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs. And you can also find me on Twitter at I Am Blankenship, which I am.
Indeed. Well, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast and for making me watch A Very English Scandal. And now's a good time to apologize for teasing this as a very British scandal for literally 3 weeks. Sorry about that. But nobody corrected me, and I guess that's just how that goes. All right. Coming up on The Blotter Presents, Piper Weiss returns to talk about Lorena, as well as the fatal effects of daytime talk shows. And after that, it's Kevin Smokler on The Onion Fields, both book and movie. Until then, if you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, you can find me on social media. That's Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter. You can also email me at bunting@the-blotter.com, and you can become an official Blotter tipster at the Patreon page, patreon.com/blotterpresents. If you like the podcast, please tell a friend and rate it on iTunes. If you don't like the podcast, please keep that to yourself. My guest has been Mark Blankenship, and as he said, he's on Twitter at IAmBlankenship. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.